Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
So I'll be talking about metabolic flexibility today. Got to point out a little bit of disclosure, but I'll be talking about metabolic flexibility in hair follicle stem cells. And just a primer on hair follicle stem cells for the purpose of this talk. They're found in this niche here. The stem cell niche is called the bulge, sitting here. And these cells are quiescent 99% of the time until they go through an activation around here to undergo several cell divisions, which gives rise to very rapidly dividing transit amplifying cells that regenerate the bottom of the follicle to generate all the cell types necessary to make a new hair follicle. And so we've been working for a couple of decades now and thinking about the pathways that will regulate this process. But what I'm going to be telling you about more is recent studies thinking about cell intrinsic mechanisms to regulate these cells. At the same time, we've been thinking about tumorigenesis from cells in the epidermis. And in a series of studies that started when I started my lab way back when, we used molecular genetics to deliver oncogenes and remove tumor suppressors under the control of various Cre recombinase drivers that would drive oncogenic hits in particular cell types, to simply ask, given a tumor, an existing tumor, how do you tell where it came from? What types of cells are cells of origin for tumors? And in this case, we studied squamous cell carcinoma, and so we asked whether stem transit amplifying cells or differentiated cells are equally or differentially able to initiate tumors. And what we found was that, in fact, a population of quiescent hair follicle stem cells appear to be the only cells in the mouse system able to initiate squamous cell carcinoma. Their transit amplifying progeny cannot do it. The differentiated, fully terminally differentiated progeny cannot do it. We've added many different types of genetic hits, multiple genetic hits, and this seems to be the case. And not even the LGR5 or more rapidly dividing stem cells can do it. It's only the keratin-15 positive cells that can do it. And so what I'm going to show you ongoing are studies where we take advantage of the keratin-15 promoter to drive Cre recombinase to make specific modifications in metabolic pathways in hair follicle stem cells. And let me give you a quick primer on cellular metabolism. Cells take up glucose, process it through a series of enzymatic steps to generate pyruvate, which can either be converted into lactate through the activity of lactate dehydrogenase, or LDH, or that pyruvate can go into the mitochondria through a complex called MPC, or a mitochondrial pyruvate carrier complex. And from there, it can go on to power the TCA cycle, oxidative phosphorylation, production of ATP, et cetera. And so we've been thinking a lot about how different metabolites get into the cell, how they're processed, et cetera. And we stumbled upon an observation when we had actually developed a in situ activity assay for lactate dehydrogenase. We had initially developed this for the study of cancer, which are known to take up glucose and produce a lot of lactate. And what we found was that if you look at lactate dehydrogenase activity, not localization of the protein, but the activity of it, it's marked here in the purple stain. And so wherever you see a dark purple, you have elevated LDH activity. And hopefully what you can notice is the hair follicle stem cells are in this bracketed region across three different stages of the hair cycle. And in each case, the LDH activity is significantly higher in the stem cells than all the other cells of the tissue. And so that led us to delete the LDH enzyme, specifically from hair follicle stem cells, using a cell type specific Cre. And when we did this, the animals, after shaving, wild-type animals will grow back their hair within about a month or two. But animals where we deleted the LDH enzyme specifically from hair follicle stem cells ended up with these bald patches. And if you look histologically, those bald patches weren't caused by the death of stem cells or the shriveling of follicles. The follicles were just fine. They were just stuck in an inactive state in the what's called the telogen phase, where there's no new hair growth. And so this was an intriguing finding. We kind of suspected that the stem cells might die, but in fact, they're just fine. They're still there. They're just not able to activate. So then we flipped the script and developed ways of stimulating LDH activity, both genetically and pharmacologically. And so when you do that and shave animals around day 50 at the synchronous stage of the hair cycle, all the follicles are in the resting phase, you see that after a couple weeks, if you stimulate LDH, you get an accelerated stem cell activation and new hair growth. If you keep going with the experiment, you get another wave of premature stem cell activation, such that with long-term stimulation, you can get two complete hair cycles in the time it takes the control to get through one hair cycle. And if you treat for a very long time, you get a, you know, Donald Trump joke. but small molecule stimulation has now been taken up by a company that I help run, and we're working towards treatments for alopecia. But most people think of LDH activity when they think of the Warburg effect, right, where differentiated tissues are thought to take up glucose and mostly use it to make pyruvate to power the TCA cycle, make lots of ATP. But tumors take up lots of glucose and instead make a lot of lactate. And this is the basis for which FDG PET imaging is used in the clinic. FDG is a glucose analog, such that you feed a cancer patient with FDG, the tumors take up a ton of glucose, and you can see it in spots all over the body. And so this Warburg effect was basically an old experiment done by Otto von Warburg, where he basically asked, what's the difference between differentiated tissue and tumor tissue? And found that tumor tissue takes up lactate, or takes up glucose and makes lactate with it. And so for the next 100 years or so, this became the dogma in the field, that every tumor seems to be doing this. And the presumption then was, well, if every tumor is doing it, it must be really important for tumor formation. And so I was surprised when I sort of backpedaled into this field that no one had actually really deleted the Warburg effect to ask how essential is it. They'd done this in vitro with cancer cell lines, but in vitro, I would argue, is not really cancer. And so we went back and looked at the Warburg effect in the tumors that we could initiate with hair follicle stem cells. So these, again, are tumors that are initiated by induction of oncogenic RAS and deletion of P53, specifically in hair follicle stem cells. And then you look at the tissue that's generated, or excuse me, the tumor that's generated, and you see tons of the purple stain. Again, this is indicative of LDH activity. So the tumors that are initiated by hair follicle stem cells have a high Warburg index. They have high LDH activity, whether you look at high grade, medium grade, or low grade. And then back to remind you that the stem cells in even the normal tissue already have that elevated activity. And so we did all these different kinds of assessments, and indeed the squamous cell carcinomas are Warburg positive. So we had already deleted LDH from the hair follicle stem cells and shown that it diminished their ability to activate. And so what happens when you delete LDH in hair follicle stem cells, which is the cell of origin for squamous cell carcinoma and glycolytic themselves? What happens if you delete the Warburg effect in these cells and ask them to then make a tumor? And so we deleted LDH while stimulating RAS and deleted P53. And in fact, hopefully you'll recognize on the H&E, it's essentially the same thing, that deleting LDH induced no changes in the timing of tumorigenesis, the degree of tumorigenesis, the pathology, the immune response, the proliferative rate, EMT, or stem cell expansion. They looked identical. We couldn't tell the difference between them. We did a couple more experiments I didn't have time to show, but if you induce LDH, so if you induce the Warburg effect in the same setting, again, there was no effect on tumorigenesis. If you induce tumors, allow them to form, and then remove the Warburg effect, also no effect. So the Warburg effect in this system, I have to be careful to say, doesn't appear to play any role or is not necessary or sufficient to drive tumorigenesis. So you might think that we failed to actually delete the gene, but here you see the LDH null tumors that form. We did the LDH activity assay, which showed no activity, none of the purple activity stain, which also indicates there was no other LDH family members compensating for the loss of LDHA. We also had tumors that were mosaic due to the nature of the Cre recombinase, and even mosaic tumors could form, and you could see stripes of LDH versus not. So while we couldn't pathologically identify any difference between the tumors with and without the Warburg effect, we did see metabolic differences, right? The LDH activity was gone. We saw changes in metabolite pools. We saw changes in glucose tracing. I'll show you that here. So if you feed animals labeled C13 labeled glucose, you can monitor where the glucose goes through metabolism. And so not only did the knockout tumors not make lactate, they stopped taking up glucose. Okay? And that led us to then repeat that kind of FDG PET experiment. And it's a little hard to see, but if you feed live animals with FDG PET, we have a small animal imaging facility. In fact, PET imaging was developed at UCLA. Yay. And you can detect tumors all over the skin. But if you look at the LDH null tumors, what you in fact find is a significantly decreased amount of FDG uptake. And so this led us to sort of rethink the role of the Warburg effect in tumorigenesis. And going back to the clinical data, well, everywhere you look, LDHA specifically is upregulated in every cancer. But then if you go and look at patient survival versus LDH expression, there's actually a lot of discordance in different kinds of cancers, which is further evidence that in humans, maybe it's not totally essential to have this Warburg effect going on. But surely cells must be compensating somehow. We do see metabolic changes due to loss of a Warburg effect, despite the fact the tumors can form. But they must be getting, if they're not taking up glucose anymore, they must be getting carbon from somewhere to power the TCA cycle, because the tumors still form. You still have cell division, which means you're still developing nucleotides and amino acids, et cetera. And so this is just a summary that when you delete that LDH enzyme, again, specifically in the hair follicle stem cells as they're initiating the tumor, you not only block lactate production, but you end up blocking everything above. And so there's some kind of recognition that LDH activity is gone, and so don't bother taking up the glucose. Okay, we'll come back to that. Then the question was, well, are they then taking up different carbon sources to compensate? And a likely source was glutamine. Glutamine has been implicated in lots of different cancers. I'll show you in a second. So we looked at glutaminase activity in the wild type versus the Warburg negative tumors, and there was a little bit of elevated activity. We looked at glutamine uptake. So labeling with C13 labeled glutamine, and we saw an upregulation of glutamine uptake. And so that led us to expand this kind of carbon metabolite tracing. And what you see here is tumors, again, normal wild-type tumors versus Warburg null tumors. And what you see is not only increased glutamine, but all the products downstream of glutamine, namely glutaminolysis. So glutamine gets taken up, turned into a glutamate by an enzyme called GLS, and that glutamate can be turned into alpha-ketoglutarate, which can then power the TCA cycle. Okay, and so this glutaminolysis pathway, similar to how the Warburg effect has been implicated and LDH has been implicated in every cancer, a similar story for glutaminolysis, where you see upregulation of GLS, or the enzymes downstream of GLS in glutaminolysis are all upregulated in cancers. And so this has led to a whole nother set of clinical efforts to try to block glutaminolysis for the sake of treating cancer. And what I haven't said yet is that all the clinical efforts thus far to inhibit LDH or the Warburg effect in cancer have failed at the clinical level. None of them have worked, despite we've had 100 years to get it right. Companies like Calithera started with the idea to block glutaminolysis in order to treat tumors, and they recently failed. And so what we then went back and asked, well, is glutaminolysis actually required for tumorigenesis from hair follicle stem cells? So we took the same approach where we take mice with this stem cell-specific Cre driver and deleted GLS, the enzyme that converts glutamine to glutamate. And so doing, you can block glutaminolysis. And as far as I know, this has never been done outside of the nervous system. We even had to pay the big bucks to have Jack's lab re-derive the GLS-1 mice because it was all done in the nervous system where people were looking at glutamate metabolism for the sake of excitatory amino acid signaling. So anyway, we coupled that deletion with DMBA-TPA, which is a standard chemical carcinogenesis protocol. You add a mutagen and then a proliferation stimulator, and then reliably about 10 to 20 weeks later, you start getting papillomas or benign tumors, but also squamous cell carcinoma. And so maybe it's not surprising now, but if you delete GLS and block glutaminolysis, you don't affect the time to tumor formation, the number of tumors, or the volume of tumors statistically. And so similar to blocking the Warburg effect, deleting this pathway specifically in the cells that start a tumor also had no effect on tumorigenesis. Just some evidence that we indeed knocked it out. We can stain for GLS-1, and you look in the GLS-1 knockout tumors, and you delete the protein. Not only that, we can do a GLS activity assay in the same way we look at lactate dehydrogenase activity, and you see a dramatic diminishment of the activity in those tumors. Furthermore, if you treat the animals prior to sacrifice with labeled C13 labeled glutamine and follow where the glutamine goes, you see a really dramatic diminishment of glutamine, not only glutaminolysis, but glutamine uptake. Okay, and so that's part of what interests me in all this, is that we're manipulating things downstream of the uptake, but somehow there's a regulation on the uptake. There's some kind of retrograde signaling, and so I'll come back to that in a second. One thing that we did notice that was pretty fascinating in the glutaminase knockout tumors, we did lactate tracing. So we added C13 labeled lactate. And turns out the GLS knockout tumors, now losing the ability to take advantage of glutaminase, actually now take up more lactate. Not glucose, they didn't compensate with glucose, but they compensated with lactate, which is interesting because, in fact, Ralph DeBardinis has shown that in human tumors, the tumors he's studied, he actually finds that lactate can be a more powerful contributor to the TCA cycle than even glucose. So that LDH enzyme goes both ways. The lactate can be taken up and converted by LDH into pyruvate. And so what we're seeing is in the GLS or glutaminase knockout tumors, they take up more lactate, and that lactate ends up getting used to power the TCA cycle. Hopefully you can see the red bars are TCA cycle metabolites with increasing utilization from the lactate. And so again, it's something about the uptake. And the uptake seems to be a key node of regulation. So we've begun to look at the transporters, the proteins that take up these carbon sources at the membrane. And we started by just looking at the expression levels of these transporters in the wild type and knockout. And so MCT1 is a lactate uptake, lactate and pyruvate transporter. We saw no difference in its expression. But MCT4, which is the same thing, another family member, it actually is dramatically increased specifically in the GLS knockout tumor. So when you block glutaminolysis, I told you that lactate uptake is increased. That correlates with a dramatic increase in the cell surface expression of the lactate transporter. earlier, I showed you, this is a recapitulation, that in the LDH knockout or the Warburg knockout tumors, you have an increase in glutamine uptake. So again, back to the uptake. So glutamine is taken up into the cell through a variety of transporters. We looked at this one called SLC1A5, also called ASCT2. And turns out if you look in the LDH knockout tumors that had an elevated glutamine uptake, you have a huge upregulation of the transporter that upregulates or that brings in glutamine. And so we then looked at a whole nother genetic model where we had stimulated LDH activity by blocking pyruvate entry into mitochondria. So we deleted that MPC carrier. Again, it had no effect on tumorigenesis by itself. What we saw there was actually an increase in glucose uptake and lactate production. Okay, so this meant when you stimulate LDH, you actually have an upregulation of glycolysis, and we can see that in the MPC knockout system. So then if you go looking at the transporter for glucose, what you find is here in the MPC knockout, you have a strong upregulation in the transporter for glucose. Okay, and then I told you when you delete lactate, you have a block of the Warburg effect and you block glucose uptake. Turns out you have a diminishment almost completely of the glucose transporter. All right, is it confusing yet? I'm gonna screw this up at some point. So all these transporters are changing very dynamically, very quickly in response to blocking individual metabolic pathways. And so the first thought is, okay, what's happening? How is this working? Let's go look at the genes. We've done RNA profiling of GLS knockout tumors and LDH knockout tumors, and there's like zero gene expression changes between them. So this is not happening at the RNA level, in fact. It's probably happening at the post-transcriptional, even maybe post-translational level. We looked at this gene TXNIP, which Allison brought up as an aging gene. And this gene is known, the protein of TXNIP, is known to regulate the expression of glucose transporter at the membrane. And so if you look at tumors, whether they're wild type or knockout, you have a perfectly inverted correlation between the expression of TXNIP and a glucose transporter. Wherever you have TXNIP, you don't have any glucose transporter, and vice versa. So I'm willing to bet Allison gets that TXNIP expression as an aging signature because it regulates the cell surface expression of glucose transporter, which is key for regulating glycolysis, which is known to be disrupted in aging molecules, in aging settings. But importantly, if you look at the overall levels of TXNIP and GLUT1, the glucose transporter, you have elevated TXNIP in the LDH knockout where you've lost the glucose transporter, okay? And just the opposite in the MPC knockout where you have elevated glucose transporter. So it appears as though TXNIP is potentially the one that's driving more or less glucose transporter at the membrane to control whether or not you're taking up glucose. So what about the ASCT2 or the glutamine transporter? Here you see the ASCT2 transporter, I already showed you this, is actually really gone in the GLS knockout. But that ASCT2 transporter is strongly upregulated when you delete LDH, right? That's when you have upregulated glutamine uptake. Okay, so turns out there's potentially a protein-protein interaction specifically between active EGFR and the glutamine transport. I don't have time to show all the details, but wherever we have decreased glutamine transporter expression, we have decreased cell surface expression of phospho-EGFR. We're not losing the phospho-EGFR. There's still tons of EGF signaling. The EGFR, it's hard to tell here, is physically translocating to the nucleus. Because it's going to the nucleus, it can no longer stabilize ASCT2 at the membrane, and that, we think, explains why there's no ASCT2 at the membrane, which explains why there's no glutamine uptake. Just the opposite in the LDHA knockout, where we had increased glutamine uptake, you have increased glutamine transporter, and you actually have elevated phospho-EGFR at the membrane. So it appears as though we have this rather complex protein-protein interactions to regulate metabolite uptake in response to abrogation of specific metabolic pathways. But long story short, none of these manipulations actually had an effect on tumorigenesis. And I guess maybe we want to figure out a way to affect tumorigenesis, right? So what we did was took a hammer to the problem, and again, back to the stem cell-specific Cre. And in this case, we knocked out GLS and LDHA at the same time, and then did the DMBA and TPA. And finally, we see an effect. You get papilloma in the double knockout, but they all disappear. At the end of the experiment, there are no papilloma in the double knockout, and certainly no squamous cell carcinoma in the double knockout. And so it appears as though if you block two metabolic pathways, it's just too much. The hair follicle stem cells can no longer initiate a tumor, or if they do, it's such a weak growth that it ends up getting absorbed. And so there. So in what I didn't tell you is in the single knockout, there are a small number of papillomas that form that end up being necrotic, okay? And so maybe I overstated that there was no effect. There's a small effect. Some number of them are necrotic. But when you do the double, you block both the pathways, now they simply can't overcome that effect on probably on their TCA cycle. You get more necrotic ones, and you get a bunch that just regress. So they show up, and then they literally, you can follow them over time, they end up disappearing. So we feel as though with that, we've defined at least the limits of the metabolic flexibility. And while doing so, we've hopefully uncovered some interesting ways of regulating these transporters and maybe interesting ways of treating cancer. So let me just summarize that the hair follicle stem cells, I started off by telling you they're more glycolytic than their progeny. Remember, they have elevated LDH activity. They're also the cancer cells of origin for squamous cell carcinoma. And squamous cell carcinoma and hair follicle stem cells are both glycolytic, namely they're Warburg positive. So I can take a little time out here to then say, perhaps tumors are Warburg positive, not because they need to be, not because they need to take up more glucose and to make lactate. Maybe they're only Warburg positive because the cell from which they derive is Warburg positive. Right, the hair follicle stem cell that started it already had the LDH activity, so maybe the tumor that it generates just has that same activity. It's just a remnant, right? We talk about cancer stem cell markers are sometimes genes that are on the cell surface of a stem cell state. Why couldn't this just be one of those? Okay, so just a food for thought. I don't know that it applies to other cancers, but there are many different adult stem cell systems where the stem cell of the tissue has been designated as the cell of origin for the resident cancer. Then blocking glycolysis in the hair follicle stem cells didn't affect their ability to start tumors. They form tumors just fine. But the Warburg null tumors compensate by instead upregulating glutaminolysis. If you just block glutaminolysis, you don't affect tumor formation, because instead those tumors start taking up more lactate as a way to power their metabolism. And hopefully what I've begun to convince you of is that a lot of this metabolic flexibility is due to post-translational regulation of the transporters at the membrane. It's a little bit, we're calling it a whack-a-mole, and we're excited that perhaps it's not driven by some epigenetic change, as everyone's always trying to shove epigenetics down my throat as a way to regulate the metabolism. I'd argue it's the other way around. Metabolism works much faster than transcription or epigenetics, and so this seems to make much more sense to me anyway. But we've also defined the limits of metabolic flexibility, again, for this cancer. And so what we're trying to do now is use pharmacological agents to block glycolysis and glutaminolysis. Can we do so with either the pathways or with pharmacological inhibition of just the transporters? The transporter inhibitors aren't as good as some of the pathway inhibitors. How does this post-transcriptional control work? How is TXNIP upregulated when at the membrane when the glucose transporter goes down? Well, TXNIP is regulated by a RNA binding protein, again, post-transcriptional regulation, and so is that at play here? But then going back further, how does a cell know that it needs to upregulate the transporter? What's the initial signal? What's the feedback? There's lots of evidence now that many metabolites in the cell actually form physical interactions with proteins to regulate their activity. So I like this idea that these are acting as rheostats on various signaling pathways. And so that gets to this, yeah, how do they know that something's been blocked? And so I'd like to take a minute to acknowledge Carlos Galvan, who did the majority of the work I showed here. He's a very talented grad student in the lab, as well as others in the lab. But a particular shout out to our collaborator, Heather Christoff at UCLA, who's an authentic expert in metabolism and has helped us do all these metabolic studies. A chemist we work with to try to develop novel small molecules to affect these pathways. Hilary Kohler and her lab helped develop the in situ metabolic assays. A little bit of informatics and then our funding sources, and thank you.
So one of the things that's puzzled me over the years is the idea that I have to have a hair follicle to have skin. Okay, so now there are many areas that you get cancer, squamous cell cancers come up, and there's no hair follicles there, as far as we can tell. So is it absolute that all of the skin derives from hair follicle stem cells? Because it could be there are two independent stem cells, for example, and one for the skin, one for the other. And my question there would be, the same pathway inhibitions succeed or fail? And then just the last part, does that loss of the papilloma, and therefore no forming of the tumor, require an intact immune system?
Yeah, all great questions. See if I can get through them. So one of them is all the skin coming from the hair follicle? If you make a massive wound and inject hair follicle stem cells, it will reconstitute the entire skin. But under homeostatic conditions, the interfollicular epidermis has its own stem cell compartment. There's debates as to whether every cell is a stem cell or whether there's a set aside, and the separately the hair follicle stem cells maintain the hair follicle. They're interchangeable under dramatic experimental conditions. The next part of that is, well, what about the generation of tumors? Does the generation of tumors require hair follicles? And in fact, if you look at the clinical data, we included a little bit of this. The rate of tumors forming on non-hairy skin, so the palms of your hands and feet, is almost nil. So we don't just have hair on our heads and our Netherlands. We have hair all over. Those hairs are not cycling. They're called vellus hairs, so there's hairs there. And I would argue that that's a decent source for cancer cells of origin. On the other hand, in mice, they have very big hairs and very thin skin. In the human, it's the opposite. We have very thick interfollicular epidermis and relatively wimpy hairs. So it's totally possible that in the human, the cell of origin for squamous cell carcinoma just statistically is more likely to be found in the interfollicular epidermis. That said, you almost never get tumors on your palms. Okay, what was the last?
Immunity.
Oh, immunity. So I've gotten this question before, and I wish I had a better answer. The tumors in the double knockout, some papillomas form, and then they quickly disappear. And I ask people who've been doing chemical carcinogenesis for the last 50 years, this happens at a small rate in all sort of genetic settings, that some tumors disappear. And so I ask those people, why do they disappear? Is it the immune system? Is it some metabolic defect? What? And everybody says, I don't know. They just don't count them because they're gone. And so I really would love to do the experiment you're talking about. Do it in a nude mouse or a Nod Skid, and see. Yeah, and people have recommended various antibodies to inject to block specific things. We haven't done the experiment. I think there's something to it, which gets to then the immune system and metabolism. The most glycolytic cells in the skin are actually immune cells. And so what's happening is there a metabolic crosstalk between the cells that are initiating the cancer and the immune cells. What I didn't show you is the most GLS positive, or the cells that are undergoing the most glutaminolysis, are also immune cells. So those we didn't knock out in this system, I'd love to knock that out as well. So there's lots more to come, but it's a fantastic suggestion.
Hi, that was a really fun talk, and I had two questions. The first is, in the last experiment where you block glycolysis and glutaminolysis, what happens to the stem cells themselves, and are you actually targeting a different cell in that system? And then the second is kind of related, and if you've looked at the mutagenic profile of the tumors in when you've inhibited different metabolic pathways, and whether you're getting the same drivers or if they're sort of slightly different tumors that are arising.
Say the second one again.
So you're inducing with a chemical carcinogen,
yeah,
but there's presumably some mutagenic event that is
okay,
prevalent in the tumor, and I'm curious if the profile of mutations is the same or if it's different depending on whether you've crippled different metabolic pathways.
Right, right. So for the second one, our friend, Cedric Blampin, has done a careful sequencing of tumors generated by chemical carcinogenesis, and it's almost always the same batch of RAS, Notch, P53, the typical things, some of which you got in your in your system. So presumably it's that. That's been prescribed to be the driver. So I don't think that there's necessarily different pathways. There aren't any metabolic pathways that appear to be regulated, although P53 is known to regulate TCA metabolism quite profoundly. And then the first question?
What happens to the stem cells when you knock out?
The stem cells. So we've been doing this because, you know, we care about hair. And so we've been doing this without chemical carcinogenesis to just delete glutaminolysis. And, of course, I showed you what happens when you block LDH. And there was a paper from Sarah Wickstrom that suggested that glutaminolysis was important for activation of hair follicle stem cells. Those experiments were done with human cells in vitro, so it's harder to say. But when we delete GLS from the hair follicle stem cells, we've yet to see a phenotype. So they get by just fine. The double, it's hard to say. From what we can see, there's no effect. Like, the hair grows back, they're okay. And so the hair shouldn't grow back necessarily because we've deleted LDH, because deleting just LDH, so there's some kind of, again, this feedback, and it gets to this basic fundamental question that we still don't know after 10 years as to why the hair follicle stem cells care to make lactate. Why do they have this elevated LDH? And why inhibiting LDH actually causes them to stop cycling, or stimulating LDH causes, we just don't know. We don't know if it's the acute manipulation or some metabolic response to the manipulation, say like taking up more glutamine. It could be that taking up more glutamine in the absence of LDH is what's actually driving the hair cycle. We can't rule it out. Hopefully it won't make a difference for our clinical trials where we're stimulating LDH. We don't totally care how it works as long as we grow hair, right?
I was curious about the LDH activation. Are you using the, whole body stimulation, or is it like a topical application?
You can do this with just topical application, for sure, in mice and pigs. And essentially, if you inhibit MPC, that carrier complex that brings pyruvate into the mitochondria, you essentially block it from going there, which means it accumulates, and it's the substrate for LDH enzyme, so you effectively upregulate the activity of the enzyme simply by providing more substrate. But you can do it topically with various small molecules. That's one class of molecules. We have another class of molecules that acts through JAK-STAT to stimulate the transcription and translation of LDH protein, and that will do it as well.
Thank you.
And maybe what you're getting at is whole body inhibition of MPC or stimulation of LDH, does that have some deleterious effect? Does that cause cancer? So it had always been suggested that because the Warburg effect is on in every cancer, if you stimulate glycolysis, you're going to stimulate cancer. And try as hard as we have for years to stimulate cancer by just promoting the Warburg effect, we've never been able to do it. And in fact, sometimes we see just the opposite.
There is the influence of mTORC receptor in nutrient sensing. So did you correlate any of these switches in metabolic pathways to mTORC?
Yeah, it's a great suggestion. Phospho-mTOR and phospho-S6, and basically the mTOR pathway is known to be highly active in hair follicle stem cells, particularly in their quiescent state, and then it diminishes as they activate. Unfortunately, we haven't really spent nearly enough time looking at it, so I can't
make any
claims.
There are real cases where starving the tumor actually has a good effect in patients. Does that starving the tumor, those anecdotal stories, correlate with what you're doing in terms of metabolic?
Perhaps. I guess you're referring to caloric restriction in cancer patients. Mm-hmm. You know, with caloric restriction, you have a huge systemic effect, and tons of pathways change, including mTOR and basically everything, which is why people get kind of fussy when they're calorically restricted. So I don't know the answer to your question. Totally possible, but there's lots going on. My colleague, Heather Christoph, is studying that specifically, so she would be better able to answer that question. So inducing tumors in the variety of calorie restriction, you do see differences depending on how you restrict calories, and so I think it's going to be extremely complicated. But it's possible that our two-hit model of blocking carbon uptake from two different pathways mimics some of that, but I can't say for sure.
Thank you.